May it please the court, my name is Kevin Dolly and I represent the appellant, in this case Karen Carpenter. This case deals with section 536.087 and the question presented by Ms. Carpenter in this case as to whether or not she was a prevailing party in this administrative appeal. Section 536.087 is specifically designed and was drafted by the legislature with the intent of aiding individuals who are subject to unreasonable actions by the government for which they have to defend themselves in an administrative action. Based on that, and when you look at the decision of the trial court as to what Judge Dowd specifically indicated in this case, we believe very clearly that Ms. Carpenter was a prevailing party.
Eckerhard versus Hensley applied. Eckerhard versus Hensley was a United States Supreme Court case that reversed the Bathke case from the Eighth Circuit. And in that case, the defendants in that case won. At that time, the Bathke case in the Eighth Circuit said if you won any part of the case, then you're entitled to fees on the whole case. But then the U.S. Supreme Court decided you can get part if you won. If there are eight issues, you won two of the issues, you could get, the court could give you one quarter of the fee, but you're still the prevailing party. The U.S. Supreme Court said you still get the money because you got relief for your client.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it was only $50,000 instead of $118,000, but still, and you get the money.
And certainly the question of the amount as to the level of success is certainly a different issue. As it relates to...
But you don't get wiped out. If you prevail in some part of it, you still prevail.
And that is what's so interesting, I think, about the White case. And when you read it closely and why it is subject to misconstruction, but at the same time, I think, did get the right outcome for that particular case. In that case, the court talks about, as you indicated, Judge, the EAJA being the foundation and backbone of 536.087. I think the confusion that lies in the Court of Appeals in the trial court's decision on that issue deals with when the court in White says that the licensee failed to prevail on the primary issue in that case. The problem with that, and the first thing you'll note is that in footnote 3 of that case, the court says that the only issue in this case was whether or not the licensee was subject to discipline. And so that significant issue description contained within White is confused by the fact that the only issue in White, the only issue was whether or not, yes or no, before the Administrative Hearing Commission, that he was subject to discipline. And so when you look at that language, and even in White they talk about that you can be prevail on other issues. We're not going to look at that here today. The problem with White is when courts have subsequently looked at it as to other issues in licensing cases, there is this subjective determination that the court feels compelled to make as to what is a significant issue in the case. And that is why we believe that when you look at the issues in our appeal, what we appealed was two questions. One, we did not believe that the trial court had, the Administrative Hearing Commission did not have jurisdiction because we argued that the appeal was not timely filed. And we argued that the discipline imposed was excessive. We did not argue that if the Administrative Hearing Commission had jurisdiction, that Ms. Carpenter could be subject to discipline. When Judge Dowd indicates or mentions in his decision that Ms. Carpenter is subject to discipline, that's not pursuant to any issue that was raised before the trial court. That's simply reflecting the reality of if the Administrative Hearing Commission had jurisdiction, which he ruled it did, then I believe she's subject to discipline. That issue was not raised before me. Is the discipline imposed appropriate? And he very resoundingly answers that question, absolutely not. And he makes very specific findings as to why that decision is not appropriate.
You argue, I think, that it doesn't have to be the key issue, the central issue, but what if it's, you know, there's five major issues, and then you say, oh, and the court entered the wrong figure for something, and they got the sense off or something. I mean, can
right.
you win on something de minimis or minor, or what role does it have to play in your mind?
So I think there is a practical analysis that has to be done by the court, and that's what's been talked about by, I believe, this court since it ruled in Milan in 1992. I'm sorry, that was a court of appeals case. And in that case, they talked about it's a practical inquiry into whether or not the material terms between the parties have changed. In this case, the reality is that today, Ms. Carpenter is not subject to discipline. She would still be subject to discipline as under a term of probation had the Judge Dowd not ruled in the way that he did. She would still be subject to the same onerous terms and conditions, which Judge Dowd very negatively talks about as to just how arbitrary, unreasonable, and shocking to the conscience, you know, subjecting people to medical evaluations and all of these other employment restrictive terms with which there is no record to support why in the world those would be imposed against her. So based on that analysis, you know, from the view between the parties, the board and Ms. Carpenter, has there been an alteration that is of material significance? And for Ms. Carpenter to not have drug testing subject to every single day costing her $50 and having to contact the board every single day and potentially be subject to changing her life around, you know, these are, as a practical matter, things that I think anyone could say matters to them. I think what Judge Dowd and the Court of Appeals has difficulty with and is the challenge of the White case is when it talks about the significant issue. And when you talk about significant issues, it's very confusing as to where you start and where you end. The significant issue, no question, before the Administrative Hearing Commission was yes or no, is she subject to discipline? The important, significant issue under before the board was what is the appropriate level of discipline? And Section 621.110 specifically contemplates two contested case hearings, one before the commission, one before the board, dealing with at least those two specific, very important issues that we have to determine in licensing cases.
Can you address the argument that the board has two capacities, one as a litigant and one as an adjudicator, and that here they're deciding on what level of discipline to impose, they're acting as an adjudicator and therefore, and not as a party, basically,
so,
and therefore can't have fees assessed against them?
I guess the first thing I would say to that is that it is a very interesting statutory scheme in which there is no question that the board acts in multiple roles, some at the same time. And before I get too far into that, I just want to note that when you look at Judge Dowd's order, I would say more than anything else, his greatest criticism of the board is in its prosecution of the case. Specifically, the timing and delay in prosecution. Timing in disciplinary cases matters. How long a person has had to rehabilitate and where they stand at the time of the hearing matters. And so his greatest problem with them, if I'm fairly reading it, beyond just the terms being so excessive, is that the terms are so excessive in that we're now 4 years, 5 years out from this happening, and we're going to be talking about this a decade after it happened. Timing matters, the prosecution of it matters, and in that role, Judge Dowd is highly critical. Now, beyond that, the statutory structure that we're talking about under 536, the hallmark and key of how I look at it and how to look at Garland from my point of view is you start with what is an agency proceeding. An agency proceeding is a contest between two adversaries by which the rights and privileges of parties are determined in a contested case. When you look at that, there is no question or dispute that at the Administrative Hearing Commission level, at the Board of Nursing hearing, and throughout the process specifically is designed to have the board act as an adversary to Karen Carpenter. They never end that role. So with that in mind.
So in Garland, they brought it on behalf of one spouse against the other former spouse trying to get child support, was that?
Correct. I think the key to Garland, as I view it, and where to start in sort of putting those two things together, is that nothing that was true in Garland that this court relied on is true in this case. The board throughout the process remains an adversary, which is not the case in Garland, where the board cannot bring the action. Here, the board brings the action, where the board prosecutes the case, where the board prosecutes the disciplinary determination while still acting as the adjudicator. There's no question they are an adjudicator, and they do serve that role as part of this case. But as is indicated in Garland, in the third section, after it talks about what is a position or decision, it indicates in the next section of the opinion, this is all premised on the idea that the board is acting solely as an adjudicator with no other role in this process. Here, they prosecuted, they offered a settlement for the same terms they offered in the final disciplinary action. They prosecuted and very heavily cross-examined Ms. Carpenter, indicated in its opinion that she failed to, rebuke what was indicated on cross, and that they defended their position when they went to the Court of Appeals.
Your opponent argues that a favorable order does not create a presumption that the state's position was unjustified. But how can the state's position be justified when the trial court found that the underlying judgment was an abuse of discretion, was against the weight of the evidence, and was arbitrary and capricious?
I agree, Your Honor. I think that beyond just sort of what the judge indicates, the fact of the matter is the record and decision of the agency is a product of those contested cases for which it is an adversary. It is a product of what was presented by that board as an adversary in ultimately reaching that decision. Thank
you. So if the attorney wins part of the judgment and not the whole thing, why doesn't Eckhart versus Hensley, which was succeeded by Gonzalez, apply? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court in Eckhart versus Hensley said, well, you didn't win on all the issues, but you won some of them, and they sent it back to Alamo Hunter to give attorneys fees for some of the issues that they wanted in his discretion. Why is that? They still improved the condition for their client.
White is consistent with those opinions. Those opinions say
Eckhart versus Hensley is the United States Supreme Court.
I understand that.
That is the United States Supreme Court. That's supreme to us.
Yeah, and they say that when a plaintiff, when the non-state party as a plaintiff brings an action against the state and prevails on a significant issue that they brought against the state, they are a prevailing party. We got the White case is the opposite thing. The state was the plaintiff, like here. We brought the action at the administrative hearing to demonstrate that there was cause for discipline, and we won on the whole case in that respect. The court found that what we alleged was indeed cause for discipline.
And so do you agree if you lost on that, they'd be a prevailing party and could try to prove you weren't substantially justified?
If there'd been a finding of no cause for discipline, uh-huh. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. When the licensing board.
Why is it different on the discipline? Go ahead.
Well, when the license, it's a bifurcated process, for one. Had we, and really it should have been remanded to impose discipline, but it ended up being a strange procedure in this case where the circuit court ultimately
Why wasn't? I don't understand. I mean, ordinarily, the circuit court isn't in the business of altering discipline?
Well, it's a good question. The circuit court initially remanded it. I wasn't in the case at the time. We chose not to appeal this eventually. But then Mr. Dolly asked them to amend their judgment and denominated a final judgment. And when that was before the court was upset that the board hadn't had a hearing yet and instituted a new discipline. And so he said, I'm going to take it into my own hands. And he imposed the discipline. We chose not to appeal that. So, I mean, it's not the way it's supposed to be done, but it is the way it was done. Had it went to back to us, I don't know exactly what the discipline would have been and whether it would have stood or not stood, but it certainly wouldn't have been a final decision from the circuit court in their favor.
Was the decision then of Judge Dowd finding, in essence, that the state's action was not justified by using the language in the judgment that it was arbitrary and capricious and abuse of discretion?
The board imposed as their role as an adjudicator was arbitrary and capricious. We defended that. The board's given a great deal of discretion in imposing discipline, and I would say our argument that was not an abuse of discretion is substantially justified, but that's not really the issue we have before us.
If I understand your argument, it's that you wear two hats, and because you wear the hat of arbiter as to the amount of discipline, you can't be subject to paying fees to the, even if the other party is held to be a prevailing party. Otherwise, you're not subject to having to pay fees. But why would it still not be appropriate to look at you, since you did have a dual role and you continued also to act as prosecutor? It's a very odd process in some ways. If you, as prosecutor, took an unreasonable or unjustifiable position and you lost on that, why can't you, fees and so forth, be imposed on you in that capacity?
Neither the state nor Mr. Dolly advocated a particular discipline before the board. We did not,
But you were the board advocating a position before the board, in effect, right?
Pardon me?
You were the board as prosecutor, too.
There is an attorney that appears at the disciplinary hearing before the board, to try to protect the record.
And who does that attorney represent?
They represent the board, and they're trying to protect the record.
And
what the statute says is that the board can consider evidence from the licensee or any other source. Now, they didn't introduce any evidence,
How is the proceeding denominated? What's its caption? Isn't it board versus...
It starts as, of course, state board versus Karen Carpenter.
So the board's a party.
Yeah, if they file it at the AHC, it starts that way. It's then later considered one decision. At the board level, maybe could be called in re discipline, but that hasn't been the habit. There's nothing in the statute that says how it should be denominated.
I think that's part of where the confusion comes here. The question of being subject to discipline was decided in the first instance by the AHC, correct?
Correct.
And there was the licensee and there was the board, and they were both advocates, and the AHC was the decision maker. And if it turns out that the AHC makes the wrong decision, the question is not whether the AHC was substantially justified, right. It's whether the position of the state was. Am I right so far?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Totally different world after that's done and you go to how much discipline, and that's decided in the first instance not by the AHC but by the board.
Correct. And their role as adjudicator.
So if we follow the same approach, then it wouldn't matter whether they were substantially justified. It would only matter whether the state's position in the discipline hearing was substantially justified.
Absolutely.
And you're telling us there wasn't a state's position at all.
The state didn't make any statement as
so
to what the discipline
the
should be.
So the person who prosecuted it, cross-examined and so forth, didn't argue for any particular sanction or didn't say that all these conditions that the trial judge found inappropriate should be imposed?
They did not.
Okay. What was their position? I'm sorry.
The prosecuting function ends when being subject to discipline is decided and affirmed, right?
Correct.
I mean, there seems to be the idea that continues back at the agency when the question is how much discipline. Is that accurate or not?
I believe that's accurate, yes.
What did the questioner do? What was their purpose and role? Why were they there?
The council was there. They introduced the AHC order into the record, which was really redundant because the statute requires that the AHC order be, sure, be referred to the board and part of the record. There was no opening. They did ask a question, I believe, in Cross about, she got into whether there was issues with service at the AHC, and they tried to clarify that for the board so that they would understand how that occurred. Mostly, the person was questioned mostly by board members, not by any council. And they did, he did, the council did call a witness in rebuttal to deal with the notice issue and to clarify what the notice issue and why they was proper for them to even be there. But that was it. They made no recommendation as to any level of discipline, nor did Mr. Dolly advocate for a particular level of discipline. He didn't say, give my guy one year probation.
So what was the issue? What were you arguing? What did he argue?
He presented his client and tried to, I don't recall the evidence he put in the record right now, what he did, but his client testified.
Is that the only occasion on which the level of discipline was an issue? Once on remand from the AHC, or had it been initially addressed by the first order?
I misunderstood that question.
Initial decision by the board to impose discipline, is that all it did in its first decision? It didn't address the level of discipline, or it did?
The AHC decides there's cause for discipline. Then they refer to the board, and the board decided the level.
And did the board take a position on the level of discipline at any time before it was remanded to it?
No.
The case was remanded?
You mean as an advocate? No.
Yeah.
And the decision, the position of the state that was found to be unjustified was the adjudicatory decision of what terms of discipline to impose.
That's correct. It was not, of course, unjustified wasn't the standard. It was arbitrary and capricious.
Do you know of any case where an agency's adjudicatory decision has been the basis for a finding for the award of attorney's fees under the statute?
No, I don't. And this court said that's improper in Garland.
To follow up on Judge Stith's question, even in the original proceeding before the AHC, when the board is an advocate, when the board is the prosecutor, mm-hmm, the charging document doesn't say at the end, and therefore the following discipline should be imposed.
Absolutely not.
It just says she is now subject to be disciplined by the board.
Correct. I wanted to, you know, address one other aspect of the Garland decision. In addition to saying just, you know, it's not proper as an adjudicator, the court further said the court must find that the state asserted an erroneous position in the agency proceeding. The only position asserted in the agency proceeding was that there was reason to discipline Ms. Carpenter. And that was clearly not erroneous. The court found that there was cause to discipline Ms. Carpenter, and the circuit court affirmed that there was cause to discipline Ms. Carpenter. Ms. Carpenter asserts that she's entitled to fees because there was a material alteration of the legal relationship of the parties. She ignores that this process started at the administrative level with her having an unencumbered license. The material change was she went from an unencumbered license to a license subject to discipline. So, you know, she may have had the consequences of her unlawful conduct ultimately reduced, but she did not prevail. I would like to address another point, and that has to do with whether Ms. Carpenter pled and proved her net worth. Carpenter is not entitled to attorney's fees under 536.087 because she neither alleged nor proved that her net worth did not exceed $2 million at the time the case was initiated. Pursuant to 536.087.3, an application for fees must show that the party is a prevailing party and is eligible to receive an award. 536.085 subsection 2 limits who is eligible for an award by defining party as to exclude individuals whose net worth exceeds $2 million. An applicant for fees, therefore, must allege and prove the applicant's net worth did not exceed that statutory figure. The Western District made that decision in Mullane v. Otto, and I'd ask
this
court.
They say that in their verified petition, they stated under oath that she lost her job and had been unemployed, was not working in any profession other than nursing, and would be homeless without the court's intervention. Is that not adequate?
That was her verified petition where she asked for a stay, mm-hmm, when she filed her motion for judicial review. which isn't, you know, there's nothing about a verified petition. A judicial review's on the record. If there's not a factual finding. That was not in her application for fees.
So there has to be an actual finding that she's not worth $2 million, which is going to be homeless?
He asserted that in his application for stay in the underlying proceeding. He did not include it in his petition for fees, did not introduce an affidavit, didn't cover it in any of the affidavits relevant to his petition for fees. He now wants you to jump back to that proceeding for an application he filed to get a stay and pull that
through.
Well,
what about, he says there was a motion where he fully adopted and incorporated by reference the motion for attorney's fees filed in October 2014, and specifically alleged in the third paragraph, petitioner is a party entitled to an award of attorney's fees and costs because she is an individual whose net worth did not exceed $2 million at the time the civil action or agency proceeding was initiated.
Why yeah, is after that we happened? After we responded, alleging that she failed to prove or allege net worth, in a motion to amend the judgment, he did state that. But he didn't amend his petition. He didn't, you know, introduce any affidavits. That was a bold statement in a second motion that was, you know, that's not neither petition nor proof. If this court has no further questions, I'd ask that the circuit court opinion be affirmed.
Thank you. Do you know of any case where the court has, the action that you're challenging, the action that you, of the agency that you claim is unjustified, is its decision entered as an adjudicator? Is that correct?
It absolutely acted as, in one of its capacities as an adjudicator. We do not deny that.
But it's the adjudication is what you claim was unreasonable.
Not
substantially justified.
I don't think that's completely correct, Your Honor. If I could just back up maybe one step. What I'm saying is, as far as that, when you look at Garland in context of what you're saying, and it's indicated in one of the footnotes, there's a question of initial eligibility for fees, as far as, number one, whether we were a prevailing party, whether or not the position of the state, and in one of those footnotes it talks about, we don't look at whether or not it's substantially justified. We need to determine first whether or not the state has actually taken a position. In Garland, they did not.
What position are you claiming is not substantially justified?
So you first start with the analysis of, and I think you can't assume that what was indicated is simply limited to the decision of the board itself.
Position of the agency do you claim was not substantially justified, and what did the trial court find? What position was not substantially justified?
The amount of time that it took before it initiated the prosecution is the key finding of Judge Dowd as to why, specific to when the board did issue its finding, that discipline was not substantially justified. Further,
what was found to be not substantially justified? Amount of time is not a position in prosecution.
You're saying their defense. Prosecution was not justified.
I think this is the key mistake that you can't make, which is that substantially justified is not strictly limited to the decision of the board. In fact, you have to look at the conduct of the parties throughout the proceeding in determining what is substantially justified or not.
The statute doesn't say conduct, it says
the position.
The position of the state was substantially justified.
Did they take a position on penalty, on discipline? They said they did not. They left that to themselves as adjudicator. But as litigant, they did not take a position on what sanctions should be imposed.
So, if I may, I feel like I'm just not answering your question. I think you have to look at and
start
with.
Can you answer that specific question?
So they did take a position on discipline, which is, as they indicated in what Judge Dowd noted as being inappropriate, which is that we can take whatever action we want so long as it is an action that is statutorily authorized. and Judge Dowd specifically rejects the board's position, and they indicated that position not only at the administrative hearing, but they specifically furthered that argument, and specifically as an adversary before the circuit court, argued that we don't need to have any concern about what it is. We can do whatever we want as long as it's within the statutory range, for example, for probation. As long as we issue probation not greater than 5 years, we are authorized statutorily to do that. We don't have to do anything else other than stay within the guidelines of the statute.
So they advocated a result to the board in their role as litigator that was not substantially justified under the statutes and rules.
Correct. So they argued.
When did that happen? And who did it? He says that didn't happen.
Well, and that's part of the frustration in our, and as far as the issue of Garland was never raised by the board until this case went before this court. Before the other courts, the board acted as an adversary and strongly indicated that it engaged in a fair process, that it could impose any discipline it wanted within the range, that it did that, that she had a fair hearing. It was not until this proceeding in the record on appeal, the transcript from the Board of Nursing, as we indicated in one of our footnotes, is not included because that was not an issue that was ever raised as far as anything relating to the positions taken by the parties at the administrative hearing being an issue before the board argued in its respondent's brief that Garland applied, contrary to the position it took before the trial court that we in fact were an adversary and we cross-examined and here is the product of that. Additionally, when you look at the position of the state, you have to recall, and again, this is why this position changing before the Supreme Court is a challenge, this prosecution requested in a settlement agreement, and the letter is attached as a record, the exact same discipline that was imposed by the board.
And is the discipline what was found not to be substantially justified?
The same discipline, Your Honor.
The discipline is what was found not to be substantially justified, and the discipline was an adjudicatory act by the agency.
It is a product of that adversarial process.
Is there a case that you know where attorney's fees have been awarded because an agency's decision, when it is adjudicating an agency proceeding, has been found not to be substantially justified?
When you look at, yes. So when you look at when you look at Sanders, you look at Grimes, and you look at Milan, they all talk about the conduct of the agency in making its decision. And when you look at the definition of what a contested case is, it is specifically a case where the legal rights and duties of specific parties who are adversaries are determined as a matter of law. And if you go through the analysis and look at what a contested case is, if you look at 085 as to what an agency proceeding is, they are an adversary. And so they necessarily, as an adversary, as a matter of law, whether or not they do it or not, they are mandated to take a position. They cannot be in
It's not a contested case if they're not taking a position.
Correct. And so they would have to be a positionless advocate in order to rule for the board.
Are there any other questions? Case will be submitted.
Thank you.